Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal. CWB Podcast. All the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating and enjoy the show.
Storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Pioneer Deez. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. Look around you, ladies and gentlemen. Take it in. Take in a breath. Welcome to the world that your grandparents created. This is not particularly an episode that I'm wanting to direct towards any one generation, but I think this is more directed towards my generation and the generation after mine. But I think this even goes back to the 1960s generation. Because there is a generational fight that was happening in the 60s. I think it's often overlooked. But there is a real generational fight. Dr. King talked about it, actually. Younger people wanted a more cooperative, loving, communal world to be built from the ashes of World War II. Bush won in his generation, wanted a more controlled world, a more authoritarian, heavy world. The Koch brothers, the remaining one, by the way, come out of that school of thought that a heavy hand trumps bad behavior. When this is never the truth, it only postpones the behavior that you're trying to avoid, which in this case is a more communal way of living, which, if you didn't know, was actually more natural. In short, what I've said many times before and what I need to say now, capitalism requires us to live unnaturally. The 1960s generation wanted a better world. Unfortunately, only a minority of that generation really wanted that world. The rest were preoccupied with playing reindeer games. The reindeer is an interesting animal. You should look up its spiritual meaning. Just type in reindeer spiritual meaning to Google. Look at some of what it actually represents. Some of the lessons you can get from it. The rest wanted to play reindeer games. They were invested in the false notion of the American dream. The American dream, which says if you try hard enough, you can climb the ladder of success. What is the ladder of success? It's a hierarchy. You can go from being no thing to something, a tool mostly, but you'll still be better off than those no things over there. They wanted to play that game. And here you may think I'm just talking about white people. Oh, no, 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 no. This kind of conversation was being had in the black community, too, as assimilation, which is what integration was supposed to accomplish, was being talked about. By the late 60s, like most white people, most in the black elite had decided, hey, I'd prefer to play this game. I'd prefer to be involved in the rat race to try to grab hold of this American dream and make it a reality for me and those who are adjacent to me. And many people today still feel like they need to make that dream a reality, even though the dream is destroyed. It's no longer possible. The last episode of The Simpsons season included a very powerful appearance by former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, where he literally talked about that. The dream is dead. But in the 60s, in the late 60s, that's what they wanted, was the dream. Now, I think it's an amazing coincidence that right at the end of the 60s, you start seeing inflation start to creep up a little bit. The economy started overheating, as they say. What the hell does that mean, by the way? The economy started overheating. The reality is, a lot of businesses found that they could charge more, so they did. But also, there were real pressures. I mean, real pressures that you don't really have to worry about today. On supplies from overseas, oil and energy, things like that. But despite those problems, most people were concerned about law and order and were concerned about a police state being implemented in order to control unruly populations. Now, let's be honest with ourselves. The majority of people who were worried about that weren't young people. They were older people. People old enough to remember World War II and to remember the McCarthy hearings and to remember the slow slide into corporate authoritarianism that happened, some of them, prior to World War II that occurred in Europe. Many of these same people said, hey, we need some of that here in the United States. Law and order is first most in our minds to control these unruly kids and to control these unruly black and brown people. And thus, the modern police state got a boost in the arm. Throughout the 70s and into the 80s, politicians only had to wave the specter of the 1960s, black people, brown people, red people, yellow people forgetting where their place was in the home, and young people forgetting where their place was in the home. In order to stoke fear and to win. Back then, a lot of Democrats did it. But a lot of Republicans were becoming smarter on how to distill their message in a way that would allow them to overcome the Democratic stronghold on many parts of the country. I often found it funny, and I never could explain it until recently. In the 1980s was really the first time that you had this kid power motivation on TV. I mean, TV wasn't really that old, but you always saw kids who were old, who were more knowledgeable beyond their years. They made mistakes like kids and things like that. But if you really watch some of these shows and some of these movies, these kids were always smarter beyond their years. And sometimes slightly smarter in some ways than the parents. And it wasn't until recently that I figured out that the reason this was occurring was because you had a lot of young people who had been impacted by the 60s and the 70s, who felt like their voices weren't heard, so they created these characters as an outlet for their frustration. Now, Law and Order became a major catchphrase in the 70s, but it went through many mutations from the 70s through the 90s. But it was still the thing that motivated people to come and to vote. And every time they voted, that police state, which they saw as a requirement to keep black and brown and yellow and red people in their place, but also young people in their place, became stronger and stronger and stronger. When the 2000 election was decided by the Supreme Court, I was going through one of the hardest moments in my life. Both my parents had passed. My family was kind of scattered at the time, and we were about to lose the home that we'd been living in for the last year and a half. When Bush was sworn in, I was living with my mother's adopted mother. And I remember watching a bit of the inauguration, and I remember the parade, or whatever they call it, when he was moving down Pennsylvania Avenue, and people started throwing, I think, eggs or something, and the cops cracked down on him. And I remember shuddering, like, oh my God, that was, whoo, wow. And like, nobody said a thing, and I thought that was the weirdest comment that actually wasn't a comment. They didn't say a thing about the heavy-handedness of these cops. As they said nothing during the Battle of Seattle, which I only learned about years later. After 9/11, when the police state apparatus began to strengthen again, I was starting to get inklings that something was wrong, but I couldn't figure out what. And it wasn't until after 2004's debacle, when I started reading more, that I started understanding what that uneasiness was. The police state, which had been begun in the 1970s, was not only codified during the Clintons, but it was intensified dramatically by the Bush regime. Obama did not roll it back. In many instances, he made it worse. Now, I wanted to start today's show off with that discussion, because as the Supreme Court has revealed itself, and the Republican plan to take back the judiciary and to drive this country into the great old days, which I kept telling y'all was back in the late 1800s, people have gotten angry, and people have started protesting more, and the police have started coming down on them like Cain. And I have seen old people say they can't believe it. Now, most of these older people are in their 50s and 60s. Some of them a little bit older than that. I was surprised with Occupy Wall Street how many people in their 60s and 70s came out to show their support. But many of these people can't believe it. And yet I'm like, do you not remember your history that you have lived? This was predictable. This was predictable. The whole reason police exist is to act as a conserving force, to stop radical changes from happening, to stop too much progression from happening. Now, I know some police officers don't like to think that. They really believe that they are that line between crime, a criminal society, and a civil society. And some of them, some of their operations do that. But if you want to understand policing, all you need to do is look at it at its base functions, not in the United States, but in what they call a developing world. Or, I'm sorry, a developing country. Because in the developed world, nobody ever asks how it became developed, but I'll pass that along right now to you to figure out. An exploitative world, anyway. In a developed country, policing has had the opportunity to mature its etiquette. So yes, it may be heavy-handed with some areas of the population, but its etiquette allows for it to have a beautiful facade that people believe in. This is what policing is, even though it's an illusion and that's not what policing is. But it was able to mature enough to have the etiquette for that facade. Whereas in undeveloped countries, that facade hasn't been developed. It couldn't be, because the country didn't have the necessary resources to develop the illusion. Now, does that mean that people still, you know, don't see the police as functionally necessary? No. In fact, many people, including I, understand that you need some force in a society that is organized in an unnatural way to stop that society from fragmenting apart and to stop the demented and twisted mentalities that come from that unnatural organization of society from doing serious harm and damage to the minds that are actually put together decently or very well. You need some apparatus to stop the bad actors from destroying and hurting the good actors. I think it's always funny, by the way, that economic strategists sometimes refer to people engaging in the system as actors, which means you're putting on a facade, but I've already covered that, have I not? You need that, though. So I have to put that there immediately for you to understand, because we are in a system that destroys a lot more than it creates, that hinders and binds a lot more than it builds and constructs and loosens and frees. So the system that is created, that has been created to keep this society from moving forward, is itself now unable to contain the pressures that this society has created by it just doing what it does. What is different about the modern era, and Noam Chomsky talked about this, compared to, let's say, the pre-World War II era, is every non-corporate outlet for organizing and discussing these problems has been made basically criminal outside of the few institutions that the system itself sanctions. These organizations were varied. Some of them were guilds. Some of them were labor unions. Some of them were associations. But they were all, to some various degree, to some varying degree, skeptical of capitalism or downright against it. And even people who did not believe in the ideologies and philosophies and the concepts of these groups still were kept honest by them existing, because if you were still having to convince people that the system would work for them, you wouldn't be too brutal. You would tolerate them. Well, like any good cancer, and capitalism is a cancer, corporations are cancer cells. Just look at what cancer cells do to the body, and then think about what corporations do to Earth and to a community. But just like any good cancer, and that's tongue-in-cheek, capitalism couldn't stand the competition and got rid of those entities that literally kept it stable. That kept it stable. Why? Because it knew sooner or later that entity was going to challenge it and possibly get rid of it because it was unnatural. So this is when you've seen the McCarthy era tear apart these organizations, leaving only the remnants of those organizations, which didn't go away overnight. They tried to, in some instances, resurrect themselves as new organizations. Their leaders and the people with the most knowledge from those organizations went on to start other new groups. But, and those groups, by the way, I don't know if there's books out there that detail this, but many of those groups torn up by the McCarthy era, some of those people went on to start other groups and things that had an impact on the 60s and the 70s. But those only lasted for a while before they themselves were destroyed. The reason this is important today is because, and I gotta applaud this generation, including my generation. Many people feel alone. They feel like their ideas, which are saying that something needs to be done about this society, that, you know, we need to build something better, they feel like they're the only ones having these discussions in their minds, and sometimes on social media, but they're realizing quickly that they're not. And the organizational structures aren't necessarily there to lift them up. I mean, they're starting to be. They are starting to be there. But they're not there like they were back then, yet. The reason I started this with look at the world that your grandparents made is because I want you to understand. We often think that we are powerless. That willpower is something that we exercise on a personal scale, and that is it. Ladies and gentlemen, that's false. That is false. Willpower is something that, yes, it comes from within us. But willpower alone doesn't get you to where you need to be. Willpower must be coupled with the ability of others to cooperate with what you are trying to accomplish. Once that occurs, you create this vacuum in reality that draws towards you the things that you need to make true whatever vision rests inside of you. The more people that attach themselves to that vision, the more likely it is that that vision is going to become a reality. This is the true danger of cooperatives and why we have been taught to think of the individual more than the collective. Because a cooperative in and of itself has a willpower that can only be distorted by the people who are within the organization. This is different than a corporation, because a corporation has a willpower that can only be distorted and driven by the people at the top. Though the instability of the corporation is often evident when you start to look at the pay structure of that corporation, who is making the least amount of money, how stressed those people are, and how much of that stress is discounted by the people at the top, who pushes them to put out more and more and more. What that tends to do is destabilize the inner core of the corporation and makes its projection into the future uncertain and unstable, and typically it leads to failure to some extent at some period of time. We are in the moment, we are in a moment in history where the destabilization of energies within corporate structures are going to cause systemic failure of the likes that we have not seen in decades. And it's all because at the core of these profit-driven entities is the need to deprive people from the certainties in life. And thus, when you deprive them from the certainties of life, you are depriving them from stability. You are depriving them from a correct and prosperous use of their willpower, their self-esteem, the building up of their self-worth, and thus the building up of their family, the building up of their community, because all of that comes from the inner vision of self. All of that comes from the inner vision of self. When you do not have a core inner vision that is positive, that means you do not have an external vision that is positive. You become an agent of destruction without even trying. And thus, when people say, that we are the creators of our own destinies. They have no idea how true that is. They have no idea how true that is. At this period in time, the stresses that have been building in this society are now at a point where literally, figuratively actually, they would become septic to the toxic to the human body if they were problems within the human body. The destabilization of the markets that you're seeing, even though it'll never be said to be spiritual, it's a spiritual emergency. It's a spiritual emergency. The problems you're seeing with Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, it's a spiritual emergency. It's a spiritual emergency. One of the greatest things that I ever heard or saw on online, on a video that I was watching, was that you have to, that for spiritual people, they have to think of the internet as the first spirit-based creation that humanity, particularly white people, have ever attempted. It is a creation that exists both in the spiritual. When you talk about the cloud, you're talking about the spiritual energy and the physical. Therefore, as was pointed out on Rap Battles, Epic Rap Battles of History, John Wick, I'll put you both in tombs. I'm sorry, let me say it again. Bitcoin, no. Hitcoin, certainly. I'll put you two in tombs, call it cryptocurrency. You're literally talking about an idea on the internet that symbolizes death. Cryptocurrency. It symbolizes death. What is put in a crypt but bodies? Dead bodies. And I think it says something that we are now looking at the potential of a global systemic collapse based on something that literally means dead currency, crypt currency, dead currency, dead currency. It is a external physical manifestation of an internal condition. I've talked to y'all about this before, so I don't want you to act like you're surprised when I'm talking to you about it now. It is an external manifestation of internal conditions. Just as when you look at the symptoms of the flu, which a lot of people like to correlate the coronavirus, COVID-19, to the flu. Okay. You look at the symptoms of the flu. The flu sometimes strikes when you are the most stressed. Is it possible that America might have been stressed in 2019, 2020? Oh, well, it started in China. Yeah. But again, do you think America might have been a little stressed during them 2 years? Look at how hard it hit us. This is what I'm thinking of here, y'all. But back to the willpower, because this is important. Through the mind, in the capacity of the being, you can create a new world. But you have to be willing to go beyond what you believe is acceptable to create. Now, here I ain't talking about violence. And here I ain't talking about Machiavelli. I ain't talking about the 48 laws of power, none of that. What I'm talking about is understanding the shortcomings of what you've been giving. And too many of y'all don't understand the shortcomings. You don't look deeply enough at this society to say these are the problems and this is how we must, or this is what we must change to overcome those problems. Yes, you can say it's the Republicans. Yes, you can say it's the Democrats. Yes, you can say it's the electoral composition of this country, which I just want to say, I was researching the other day, parliamentary seats in Britain, and I was shocked to learn that for a country that is less than 100,000 square miles, it has over 200 more seats in its parliament. Just the House, I forget which one it is, but one of them has over 200 seats and the other one has nearly 300 seats more. The House of Lords has nearly 300 more, just over 700. America, I mean, oh my God, really? 435, which by the way, I did a little bit of checking. The House, the chambers were built 1801. At the time period, there was 106 representatives in the House. They were representing about 50,000 people per representative. Something needs to change with that. I mean, feasibly speaking, the House of Representatives should probably have 2,500 members. Now, of course, you'd say, well, that'd be crazy. It wouldn't, actually. You could organize that, actually, pretty well. Or if you wanted to double or triple the number of the House staffers and do something more underneath it, then you could make it work. And the Senate should definitely be much larger than it is. But anyway, there's a reason why that's the case. And most of you can't answer why. Chris Hedges has touched on it, the fear of the populace, the fear of the populace, but there's more to it, and that is it. Once you start to answer that more to it, man, then you start putting yourself in position to really reconstruct this world. And look, the wealthy know that reconstruction's coming. They do, and they're acting like they know. The question isn't, are you going to allow them to take this country from you? The question is, are you going to prepare yourself enough to rebuild it? To rebuild it. Because most of y'all ain't ready for that. Most of y'all don't have the vision for it. See, the wealthy can make things occur because they have a vision for this country. It ain't good for you, but it's great for them. Do you have a vision? Can you put a vision together? If you can't, can you learn? Maybe you should try. Maybe you should try. Well, what does a vision entail? Start by researching something that business people know about. It is called two things, SWOT analysis, S-W-O-T analyses. And then secondly, how to write a vision statement. How to write a vision statement. I'm going to leave y'all today, and I know it's been a while since I've been here with you, but I'm going to leave y'all today with a couple of book titles that I got in, and because look, when in order to have a proper vision, you must have some information. And I was watching I think it was on Sam Cedar's Spot, which I didn't realize he was an actor, by the way, and I've actually seen some of his work. But they were talking with a woman. It was on Sam Cedar's Spot. They were talking with a woman who had written a book on the budgeting process. Now, many of you may think that when I say budgeting process, I'm just talking about the budget that the Congress deals with each year. But for the federal government, there's actually a budgeting system that goes beyond, well beyond, I mean well beyond the Congress. I mean, it talks, the budgeting process talks about, you know, giving money to the states, giving money to communities, giving money to regions, giving money to the departments and the bureaus and things like that. It's actually quite intense when you get into it. There's a lot of parts to it. And this woman was talking about how, I can't remember exactly when, but sometime in the last 50 years, the budgeting philosophy of the federal government changed, and that's actually why you've had some of the financial problems that you've had in these last several decades, at least the last three. Because the philosophy changed. Now, how many of you knew that? I didn't. But immediately, I got online, did some looking quickly because I was on my way, you know, to leave to go to work. And I found a book that talked about the budgeting process and managing budgets and things like that. It's an older book, and you know me and my older books. I always tell you, I love my older books. I was very happy with this book because I received it in, and it's an old library copy, and it had a beautiful old library. I forgot what they're actually called. But one of the cards that they used to use back in like the 60s and 70s, where they would stamp the date and you would sign it. So I love it because somebody took this book out in July of 72 and July of 73 and August of 73 and December of 75 and April of 78. And then again in 80, a couple, yep, 86, May of 86, and June of 88. So, I love it. I love it. And I would read some of these names, but I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to go and do that. Anyway, I love that type of stuff, you know. The small things makes you happy because it means that the book has some personality to it. And just to let you know, I'm not getting rid of that card. Not going to do it. Hopefully one day I'll be able to tell my nieces, nephews, great nieces, great nephews, whoever it is, you know, about the time we used to use these little these little paper things here. Anyway, so the title of this book, so the book is by Lyden, L-Y-D-E-N, and Miller, and the title of the book is Planning, Programming, Budgeting, A Systems Approach to Management. Okay? So, there's that book. And then, there is this book. And this is one that I've been looking at for a couple of years. And by a couple of years, I mean 10. And I finally broke down and got it. It is a book that was smuggled out of Russia in parts back when it was the USSR, and it is about political psychopathy. The book is titled Political Punerology, P-O-N-E-R-O-L-O-G-Y. The author is Andrew Lobeckswit. Sorry, I'll just spell it. L-O-B-A-C-Z, yeah, A-C-Z-E-W-S-K-I. Interesting book, if it is in fact completed. There's some questions about whether or not it's complete or not. And then, Downsizing Federal Government Spending by Chris Edwards. And You know, there's probably a bunch of others that I can tell you to get. I will say, because I have quite a bit of them, and I have been looking up a lot of books. Well, there'd be at least one more. The Caveman and the Bomb, Human Nature, Evolution, and Nuclear War by David and Judith. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was a husband-wife team, but it's not. It's David Barash, B-A-R-A-S-H, and Judith Lipton, L-I-P-T-O-N. The Caveman and the Bomb. And then, finally, I guess I have to give you this one, because if I don't, I think I'll regret it and wish that I had. The Cato, C-A-T-O, Handbook for Policymakers, the eighth edition, which is from 2017, if I'm not mistaken. Really get that book, y'all. Get that book. No joke. Get it. Get the book. Because the Cato Institution releases these books, and they go to Congress, and Congress works from those playbooks. When I was talking about, do you have a vision? Guys, I'm not joking. These people have a vision. They have a vision. And then a couple of additional books that are interesting to consider. Susan Herbst, H-E-R-B-S-T, is the author. Numbered Voices, Susan Herbst. Check that out. And I suppose that'll be it. So I'm glad to have given y'all this presentation today. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know, you can always reach out to me. I'm your brother, Vyamir Deese. Yeah, I don't know if, you know, how often I'm going to be publishing these things, but here's one more for you, okay? I'm your brother, Vyamir Deese. Talk to you on the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and there are lives in the balance.